program, which is part of the Office of Public Interest Advising here. The Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, and the Center on National Security and the Law at Georgetown Law Center. I want to take a moment to introduce Phil Malone from the Berkman Center, who has been our partner in this endeavor, and who will have a few words to say. Phil, where are you?
Thanks, Joan, and thank you everyone for coming. Thanks to all of the panelists especially, and I just want to add a special thanks to some students from the Harvard Journal on Legislation who put in some heroic work to essentially excerpt the transcripts of the Mukasey confirmation hearings for the use by the panelists Josh Stern, Ryan Bushell, Brian Chernoff, Dan Friedman, Rachel Murphy, and Robert Williams. Really helped a lot to get us ready for the presentation today. So thanks to all of you.
Great. I think we've pointed out that there is a wiki that has been put together by the bunch of students at the Berkman Center, for which we want to thank them very much. I'm not going to go through the wiki URL, but it's available both at Georgetown and, oh, I think we're seeing our panelists now at Georgetown. That's great. Both the wiki is available both on the website at HLS and I'm sure at Georgetown as well. And now I wanted to introduce Professor Neil Katyal, from Georgetown Law Center, who is the director of the Center on National Security and the Law and is our partner in setting this event up. And he'll introduce the panelists in Georgetown, and then we'll take it back and introduce the panelists in Cambridge.
Thank you very much, Joan. It's a delight to do this with all of you at Harvard. We at the Georgetown Law School are launching a new Center on National Security and the Law, which is devoted in large part to the exploration of the issues that we are discussing today. I have to confess, this feels like one of our old civetses that David, that you and I used to be on at the Justice Department from looking at you like this, but I think, I know this is a difficult technological experiment, and I appreciate the patience of everyone in dealing with the invariable delays. We have an all-star cast here in D.C. as well as in Cambridge to talk about this set of issues. To my right is Jamie Gorelick, the former Deputy Attorney General Extraordinaire in the Clinton administration, before that the General Counsel of the Defense Department, and now a partner at WilmerHale. To my immediate left, the former Office of Legal Counsel head extraordinaire in the Clinton administration, Walter Dellinger, also a Duke Law professor, also former Solicitor General in the Clinton administration. And then to my far left, only for physical purposes, is Viet Dinh, a professor here at Georgetown, formerly Office of Legal Policy head extraordinaire in the Bush administration, and before that had a series of government jobs as well. Thank you very much, and I think there'll be some introductions on your end, Jim.
Thank you, Neil. I'm Jim Pflug, and I am related to both of these institutions. I'm a Heyman Fellow at Harvard, Senior Heyman Fellow, and I am the to-be acting director of the Federal Legislation Clinic at Georgetown. I have with me, to my far left, again, only geographically, Charles Fried. Charles has been teaching since he came to Harvard in 1961 with time out for several years as Solicitor General of the United States, 1985 to 1989, and then time out again from 1995 to 1999 as Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, after which he has returned here to Harvard. David Barron is, I should mention that Charles is not a graduate of the Harvard Law School. He's a graduate of Columbia Law School, so let no one think that we're parochial around here. David, however, is a graduate of Harvard Law School, and has been an assistant professor of law and professor of law here since 1999. He also served in the Justice Department during the Clinton administration in the Office of Legal Counsel, and he is the co-author with Marty Letterman of Georgetown of a forthcoming, very important and long set of articles on separation of powers, which we will all get to study either as teachers or students. We're going to keep, Neil and I are going to keep our comments to the minimum and really let the panelists go whichever way the discussion takes them. One caveat that some of the panelists may have actual clients who may have interests in some of the subjects that are discussed, and those panelists, as they prefer, may either withhold any comments on that part of the discussion or disclose their interest in that discussion and partake in that part of the discussion. So as the very long title of the event indicates, we're going to be looking back at the Mukasey confirmation hearings. They were clearly very important hearings as nomination hearings go. They changed minds. They changed votes, both in the committee and in the rest of the Senate. They focused on extremely important and difficult issues, one of which, as late as this morning, took a step forward when Chairman Leahy rejected the claims of executive privilege by the White House with respect to three White House witnesses who were subpoenaed to testify at the Judiciary Committee with respect to the U.S. attorney firings, and the Judiciary Committee has now ordered them to respond to the subpoenas. So that issue is one that is now joined, and I'm sure that will come up because Attorney General Mukasey cited, among other things, Walter's writings on that subject, and I think Walter may have something to say about it. But we will go through and begin the proceedings by asking each of the panelists to tell us what struck them as an extremely important legal issue from the hearings, either because it clearly revealed that the new Attorney General has or might have positions different from the prior positions of the current administration, or because it suggested that he intends to stick with somewhat problematic positions that the administration has taken. And we will start.
Who's your client?
What's that?
Who's your client?
We will start. I am a total neutral, as I always am in these proceedings. We will start with the senior person in terms of Justice Department position at the D.C. end, and that's Jamie Gorelick, the former Deputy Attorney General.
Thank you, Jim. Rather than parsing Judge Mukasey's words, which I think we will certainly get to, I was struck by his attitude, which was, in general, to speak about the necessity of accommodating Congress, the necessity for sharing such things as Office of Legal Counsel opinions and making them public, except in limited circumstances, and we can talk about how limited they might be. And his praise for Jack Goldsmith's book, which was highly critical of any number of actions that the White House and others in the administration took that got the Justice Department in the mess that it's in. And maybe I'm being Pollyannish, but I do believe that his promises to review Office of Legal Counsel opinions himself, his view that the Bybee memo was a grievous mistake at the very least, suggests to me that he is going to take a different tack and push back on tactics which, in truth, have resulted in a weaker executive branch rather than a stronger one when the tactics originally were part of an effort to strengthen executive branch authority.
Walter?
What I was struck by was, in a sense, a deep ambiguity over the essential question of whether the president has to obey the law, mm-hmm. which resulted in some people thinking that Judge Mukasey had brought a breath of fresh air by indicating more willingness to abide by acts of Congress, and others wrote op-eds saying that he would be the lawbreaker in chief. And I think it just illuminated how much has been missed in the debate by those who haven't read David Baron and Marty Lederman on this subject of the president's law-abidingness. Let me just say a word on this. I think there have been two category mistakes. And Judge Mukasey's answers to the question, is the president required to obey federal statutes? They strike me as at least the oral answer was touchingly ambiguous. He said that would have to depend on whether what goes outside the statute, beyond what the president is authorized to do, nonetheless lies within the authority of the president to defend the country. Professor Rubenfeld thought this an invitation to executive lawlessness, and that is one way to read it. His written answer submitted later was different. The written answer was the president must comply with a constitutional law passed by Congress. So far, so good. The next sentence is, if a law falls outside the Constitution, however, the president, of course, must follow the Constitution, which is our nation's highest law, which I also think is probably right, except for the oddity of the phrasing of a law falling outside the Constitution, rather than talking directly in terms of unconstitutionality. And I think just to short circuit this debate and get to the point, I think there have been two category mistakes made. Critics of this administration's assertion of the power of the president to decline to obey acts of Congress have confused the existence of the power, which I think to be wholly legitimate, with its abuse, which is not. That is, it has been said by the ABA, for example, that no president should ever sign a bill and announce that he will refuse to comply with the provision of it. Every president has done that. Every president has an obligation to obey the Constitution, and I think it is a well-established and essential function that the president have the authority to make his own decision about what laws are constitutional and not to enforce those which, in the president's view, are not. The question I would have, the focus on that issue, misguided focus, arguing the president doesn't have that authority, misses the point that the power can be abused. And my concern is not the president's announcing his authority to act on his own constitutional views, but what those views are, and those views being, I think, indefensible in the following respect, which I will mention quickly, which also is what troubles me about the ambiguity of Judge Mukasey's statement. The other big confusion is to conflate two uses of the word inherent authority of the president, or power to defend the country. One is the power a president would have when Congress has not acted. And the other is the power the president has after Congress has acted to violate the statutes Congress has passed. And I know that Professor Yu, who authored many OLC memos as Deputy Assistant Attorney General, consistently conflates these two. I think a president has broad power to act in the national interest when Congress hasn't acted. That is, I would be hesitant ever to say a presidential action was invalid purely because it was ultra vires. But when Congress is enacted acted within its powers by passing a law, the general assumption is that Congress, that the president would have to obey that law, and that his inherent authority to act in the absence of congressional actions does not mean that the president has the authority to violate acts of Congress. So I think what emerged from the Mukasey hearing, I'd like to hear from others, is that some ambiguity in his answers as to where he fell on the down on these issues.
Thank you, Walter. Charles, do you want to go next?
Certainly. Well, I thought the hearings were profoundly depressing, and later on, I'll be happy to explain what depressed me. But they did lead me to say that I think we ought to take a step back, way back, and see what the context is. The context, I would take all the way back to Richard Nixon. very skillful politician, very intelligent man, and a man of the poorest character that I think anyone who has ever inhabited the White House, a very bad person. His bad behavior, his bad instincts, his bad character created a situation where it could plausibly be said that the political system and the country had simply lost confidence in him. But unfortunately, in our constitutional system, there is very little that one can do about getting rid of a president in whom the country has lost confidence. Very little short of impeachment. And that, of course, is what unwound and did, in fact, get rid of the man. The trouble is that we drew entirely the wrong lessons from that episode. We passed a whole raft of unnecessary and sometimes distinctly stupid legislation to solve problems which it didn't solve. And I count among the very stupidest the FISA law, which is not only obsolete, but was dumb on the day it was passed. The Levy memos and the Levy rules separating the CIA from the FBI and prosecution from investigation, terrible stuff. The independent counsel law, which it took Ken Starr finally to get destroyed. The very defective election financing laws, and there are many, many others. But mainly what it did was it created an atmosphere that the way you deal with a president who has lost the confidence of the country is through criminal prosecutions, through legal harassment, through all kinds of things like that, which by and large turn out to be beside the point. We saw that in every other such instance thereafter. Consider Iran-Contra, where there were criminal proceedings, and they always, as is always the case, had to do with totally peripheral things like who paid for a security fence and perjury and things of that sort. And the absolute, well, that was tragedy, and the farce was, of course, Whitewater, which was nothing to begin with and led to only the second impeachment of a president in our national history over a, well, I will not finish the sentence, but you know what it would be if I did finish it. And, of course, what we have seen is an atmosphere of payback after payback after payback. And what we're seeing now, again, is more payback. And I'll stop at that point.
Yeah.
Are we back to D.C.? First of all, thank you very much for this the opportunity of the joint cooperation, but also to share the podium with this wonderful group of people. I know that David and Marty's work is very influential in this area, and they should be properly recognized. They're not just simply commentators, but they are very good scholars and active participants in this process. And it has been a quite a interesting process to watch to see the effect of academic thought and analysis and research in the political arena. I'll take off where Walter left it, which is this ambiguity in Judge Mukasey's answer, both in the oral presentation and in the written questions. I do not think it. I do admit that there is an ambiguity. I do not think that it is an ambiguity resulting from deliberate obfuscation, but rather that results from a very hard constitutional issue. And like all hard constitutional issues, it's all a matter of characterization, as you all know in terms of the oral advocacy or Supreme Court advocacy, those who would focus on the president as the lawbreaker in chief, to use the derogatory term, or an executive override of the statutory commands, would think of it as the president putting himself above the law. And Judge Mukasey, I think, fairly artfully and truthfully says that, no, that's not the right analysis. No person is above the law, but everyone is under the Constitution. The delta between those two positions, of course, is what room is there for executive authority left after a statute has been passed. And I think Walter's analysis of the different sections of Justice Jackson's concurrence in Youngstown Sheet is exactly the right thought about it. Of course, the whole debate is what is the meaning of the executive authority within the your own view of the Constitution, and that's really where the debate should lie, as Walter so articulately defined it. It is not whether the president has a residuum of power, but whether or not his assertion of that residuum is the correct assertion. And here the analysis, it seems to me, is quite parallel to a less controversial and less political context. That is the duty to defend acts of Congress generally, and the corresponding duty to the court not to defend acts that the president thinks is unconstitutional, and then therefore the procedure to notify the Congress that the executive would not defend portions of the act. When you have that type of situation, but in the context of executive action and executive enforcement actions, you don't have an opportunity to send that type of no defense letter, and so the executive's ability to not follow the law is essentially a sub rosa, or sub silential at least, a silent no defense letter. And I think the task of this type of the conversation is to bring the silence to the fore, so that it make it equivalent to a no defense letter, well articulated, and the executive has to justify its position as to why it is not defending or not enforcing or not following a particular statutory mandate, and therefore put that up to the legal, public, and political debate to assess whether or not that assertion is valid or not. I do completely agree with Jamie that this debate will continue as it has in the last 100 years, and will continue for going forward. I think the most promising part of the hearing is the tone. And Judge Mukasey does not mince words about it. And he says that, hey, if push comes to shove, I will defend executive authority as I best see it. But I don't want push to come to shove. I want to, in the first instance and in the main instance, always to try to work with Congress in order to be in concert with Congress rather than to be in antagonism of Congress. Even those who believe in a strong separation of powers, like me, even those who believe in a strong and robust executive the authority, like me, I think has to commend that type of approach to governance, because the separation of powers and interbranch conflict are the hard cases that quite often make bad law. Good law, good governance works when all the branches work together, especially the political branches, so that these kinds of hard questions are not punted to the judicial branch.
David.
I think Charles is right to think that the way to approach the hearings is to put it in a larger context. And the context that strikes me is there were really two separate issues of concern with respect to the direction of the Justice Department and the executive branch over the last several years, one of which had to do with potential partisan influence and a lack of independence in the Justice Department. It was just becoming a tool of sort of the Republican Party or electoral goals of the White House, and that was, I think, widely viewed as troubling, if true. And the second issue concerned this debate about executive power and the powers of the commander-in-chief. That's not necessarily a partisan issue. It's not necessarily a political issue or inappropriate for the president to have a view on those questions. But it was an aggressive view, I think, by everyone's lights. Some people thought it was correct, but nonetheless was a strong assertion of power. But I think it's important to view those as separate. And my sense is, to some extent, there was a bit of conflation in our reaction to the McCasey hearings on those two dimensions. My own view is that Judge McCasey on the first dimension is a tremendous asset to the Justice Department. He's clearly someone who comes from independent and outside the White House. It's not a former White House counsel or anyone particularly close to the president. And by all evidence, he has great respect for the Justice Department, its traditions of independence and neutrality. And I think his answers on that score, and even his actions after getting into office, all suggest that he takes very seriously the commitment to keep it from being a politicized institution. On the second score, though, and the question of the executive power of the president as commander-in-chief, I found the hearing encouraging in the respect that it was quite a substantive hearing. I guess I have a different reaction than Charles. It didn't strike me as payback. It seemed that there were serious questions being asked by both Republicans and Democrats, purely on legal questions, which were frankly and forthrightly answered to some extent by the Attorney General in the sense that he engaged with them. He didn't just give a lot of rhetoric that we're used to seeing in Supreme Court confirmation hearings over the last 10, 12 years or so. So it was a substantive hearing, and that's encouraging. And I think that's why, as Jim said at the outset, I think minds were changed. In other words, you actually could learn something about the views of this person on this set of legal questions and the views of the senators on these legal questions. What I found troubling, though, is I think that a fair read of Judge McCasey's answers signaled that he was not actually particularly troubled by a relatively aggressive view of the president's commander-in-chief powers. He didn't come out and say that I agree with David Addington right down the line, but he really never at any key moment took issue with any of the positions. And that, I think, is of concern, not because it's unlawful to have such a view or it's a criminal act to have such a view, but because I think those views are profoundly wrong and a misunderstanding of our constitutional tradition, I think, in a very grave and important area. So it's troubling to me that the Attorney General signaled that he was signing on to them in some way. If you think of Ed Levy and what he did on similar sets of questions, he made it perfectly plain that he did disagree with prior legal views of the scope of executive power, which is why he testified on behalf of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and its constitutionality. He was pressed in hearings about these questions. Aren't you giving away too much? And he said, you know, I know they don't like me to say this, but as Attorney General, I don't think the president has the power here. I think he can be restricted in some ways. There was really no equivalent statement, I think, by Judge McCasey. And I think what's troubling to me is in the weeks after his confirmation, all the indications are that he actually is still of the view that the president has quite broad commander-in-chief powers to act in contravention of statute. And I'll just point one example. There was a statement of administration policy issued in response to a pending supplemental appropriation bill that would have restricted the president's power to authorize interrogation practices inconsistent with the Army Field Manual. The Statement of Administration Policy, which had to have been approved by the Attorney General, said that he would recommend a veto of that legislation, and why? Because he thought it would undermine the interrogation program that had been conducted since 2001, which he says in the Statement of Administration Policy was a vital and useful mechanism for achieving the goals of intelligence collection. That program, by all evidence, included waterboarding. It goes on to say that there's no need for further legislation in this area of interrogation, and it concludes with a sentence saying that legislation restricting the president in this way would be inconsistent with the president's obligation to defend the nation. And I think you put that all together. That sounds very much like a set of answers which aren't really ambiguous as to the views of the Attorney General, and that, I think, is of concern, not because it's illegal, he should go to jail for it, but again, as I say, because I think it's a profoundly wrong way to understand the separation of powers.
Thank you. By prior agreement, what we will do is have a kind of almost rebuttal round and various comments among the panelists to each other. And Jamie, I know, has some thoughts.
Well, I'd like to follow up on the discussion that Viet teed up, which is about what do you do when there is a disagreement as to the constitutionality of a law. I mean, McCasey said the president is not above the law, and I think we should, I think, all be able to agree on that. But there are instances, as Walter says, in which a president concludes that a part of a law is unconstitutional. Now, in my view, that should be an extraordinary circumstance, not an ordinary one. That's a position that should be taken with great care. It should be taken with due cognizance of the views of other branches. You have to be very sure about it. But most importantly, and this is where I wanted to pick up on what Viet said, I think you need to be candid about it. I mean, and in this respect, the whole hullabaloo over signing statements is, as several of our colleagues here on the panel have noted, has stood the issue on its head. Because, in fact, a signing statement is one mechanism for saying, I disagree. Now, the question is how public those are, how much attention people are paying to them. But it seems to me that there should be an obligation on the part of the Department of Justice and the administration to tell Congress ahead of time, if it's about to pass something that the executive branch would say is unconstitutional, so that there can be a debate and not find out after the fact that the executive branch doesn't agree with what Congress has done and doesn't agree that it's constitutional. And second, should lay out in a signing statement what it's going to do. Now, in a political circumstance where you actually have a branch, the legislative branch in the opposite party, you can actually get some oversight and some public debate, which might affect the course of enforcement. So that's one comment I would make that I would like to hear my colleagues' thoughts on. The other is to probe a little bit what Walter and others have talked about in looking at the category, the third category in Youngstown, where Justice Jackson says if Congress has acted, the president's authority is at its lowest ebb. He didn't say it's not existent at all. He said at its lowest ebb. So the question is, what does that mean? And that is, if you read, and I knew we would get into parsing, which we really quickly did, if you read what Mukasey said, that's what he said. He said it's at its lowest ebb, but it's not nothing. And so what does that mean? I mean, one can think of all kinds of hypotheticals. But I think that's really that delta that Viet talked about is really where the rub is. And it could be narrow, or you could drive a truck through it. And I think that's the big issue.
Jamie, before we go on to Walter, can I just probe you a little on that? What do you think the answer is? Suppose Congress passes a law that says, President, you may not take that hill in Iraq. Is that, and the president says, oh, I want to take that hill, and does so. Does the president have that power under that category?
I think in the national security area is where you're likely to find any source of authority that might remain in that ebbed context. So let's say there were a bill like FISA, and it appeared to cover the waterfront, and an attack were imminent. And the president concluded that if he could go up on a line in a certain way, he could prevent the country from being attacked. And he just does it and figures we'll deal with it later. Now, there are lots of problems with what happened, which is that nobody surfaced the issue, nobody talked about it later, et cetera, et cetera. But I would think that if it were anywhere, it would be in the national security arena in an emergent circumstance. I actually testified on this. Just to put a little history out on the table, when after the Alder James spy case, the Justice Department was challenged by Alder James's counsel on how we could have authorized on our own signature essentially black bag jobs going into Ames's house and car and looking at what we wanted, taking pictures, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of the evidence in the case was based on that. After that, the Attorney General Reno said, I don't want to be in a position anymore where I could be challenged. So I want you to go seek, Jamie, go seek authority to extend FISA to physical searches, because I want to have the imprimatur of Congress on this so that if there is judicial review, I'm much more likely to prevail. Being risk averse, of course, and having the good counsel of Walter Dellinger and Randy Moss and others, I went to Congress and I said, we have the inherent authority to do this, of course, because we just had. But we think it would be the better practice for you, Congress, to act. To me, that is was a statement in the first prong, whereas Congress had been totally silent. Of course, my statement of inherent authority of the president in that area of national security has been used as evidence that all presidents, including Democratic presidents, have asserted inherent authority for the president to act in the broadest scope of his national security mission. I don't think it stands for that, but I do think there must be something left in that ebb.
Walter?
I think Judge Mukasey stuck by the correct assertion that presidents have the authority to disregard acts of Congress that are unconstitutional without, perhaps not being pressed enough, but I agree with David Barron, without going forward to express concern about how sweeping the assertion of what's unconstitutional is. Let me give you an example. Take a case like FISA. It is said by the defenders of what the president did that every president, going back to Lincoln, have authorized eavesdropping. Johnson, Roosevelt, others authorized wiretapping of the national security interest. I'm perfectly willing to accept that as part of the inherent power of the president. When there's no law in it one way or the other and it's in the national security interest, I would be hard-pressed to say that a president doesn't have an inherent authority to take those actions that are necessary. Now, what, of course, is amazing about the argument that that's a precedent is that those actions all preceded a decision by Congress to enact into law the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which said, here's how you do it, and if you don't do it this way, it's a felony. And I think the simple reasoning of John Yoo was that if it was in the president's inherent authority before Congress acted, obviously the Congress can't interfere with the president's inherent authority, and so it is valid after the fact. And I think that is a vast expansion of what would be a residual core of presidential authority in the teeth of a determined congressional action when Congress is acting within its scope. I think it is a very, very narrow, almost hypothetical category where the president, in the area of national security, now Congress passes lots of laws that are unconstitutional, which presidents, every president notifies if they're not going to enforce, they're not going to defend, where there are clear Supreme Court precedents in point. But in the area of national security, it's very small. In my view, it's almost related to the category of who the president can choose to carry out his orders. The president is invested with all executive authority, and I, for one, have and this is, goes beyond where OLC does, even in, I think, even in the Republican eras, I don't believe Congress can tell the president who he can nominate to be Secretary of Defense or foreign trade ambassador, that the executive power is for the president to carry out, subject to Senate confirmation. So a fairly strong view that there's a category there. But Congress can define what any of those officials do as a matter of law, and I think they're very strange assumptions. If Congress passed the law saying a president can't go up a hill, and I think either David Barron or Maury Lederman raised this with me, if Congress passed a law saying the president cannot go up a certain side of a hill, you know, they would probably have a pretty good reason for doing so, like it was the holy shrine and would launch, you know, a Middle Eastern war. And so it's a harder question than you might think from the hypothetical, if you might imagine what would lead both houses of Congress to enact such legislation. One simple point, one thing that would be easy, for example, if after 9/11 they said we cannot get all the FISA warrants we need within the 3 days that are required by the statutes. White House counsel will have no hesitancy to say that you can blow past the 3-day deadline. But note, however, the statute says as soon as practicable, and you're still bound by that. And But this administration just said, well, it's a constraint that it's unconstitutional and we won't abide by it without ever making any serious showing as to how they would be inhibited by doing so.
Charles?
Well, it's time for me to explain why I thought the hearings were depressing. one thing that clearly appeared is that Judge Mukasey, General Mukasey now, is exactly the kind of person who should be in the Department of Justice, exactly the kind of person with whom the president should have surrounded himself from the beginning. Very smart, very tough people who shared his basic stated values, his public stated values, and who did not depend on the president. They were his appointees. They were going to do what they thought was right. And if it came, push came to shove, you'd say, okay, I'm out of here. That's what you need. And he's obviously that kind of man. The place where it showed up was in his contrasting discussions of torture and electronic surveillance. I have expressed my contempt for FISA. The point is that Mukasey gave the idea that that electronic, unwarranted electronic surveillance was wrong, if it was wrong, because it was illegal. Torture, on the other hand, is illegal because it is wrong. And there's a huge difference. And only a person with a strong moral compass, not mired in the kind of legalisms which these hearings displayed in ample magnitude, can see through that. And so he was terrific. And we're lucky to have him. It's a pity he came so late. We're lucky to have him. But then you see the obsessional, repetitive attempts to hem him in, to get him to say something he doesn't want to say, has clearly indicated he doesn't want to say, to trip him up, to extract from him concessions and commitments, which he doesn't want to do. And it happened over and over again. If you look through this transcript, you see the senators coming back again and again to the same thing in an obsessive fashion, like some kind of an interrogator with a defendant, hoping that finally the person will slip up. It's a terrible way to run politics.
David.
Charles is speaking like someone who's clearly been through a confirmation hearing, as I have not. Two things. I think that Jamie's right in saying that the key issue is, as both Walter and Viet also said, is this delta. What is the content of this? And I guess, you know, just refer you to 270 pages forthcoming in the Harvard Law Review that tries to explain what the delta is. But what I...
You're not a very environmentalist, David.
Right. I think what's worth taking away just some large points. One is, it's not that the commander-in-chief power is nothing. He's the commander-in-chief. And that means there is a chain of command which is beyond statutory alteration. You cannot make the Secretary of Defense immune from the orders of the president, as the Congress tried to do with General Grant at the end of the Civil War. Right? You can't pass statutes like that. I think it's clear for the president to object and say they're unconstitutional. As to the substance of what the president is doing as commander-in-chief and laying down restrictions on his substantive authority to do things, I think it's plain to everyone that Congress has lots of room to place restrictions in that realm. The difficult question then becomes, okay, well, what are there any limits to the substantive restrictions it can lay down? I mean, we know that the president, in the absence of statute, would have an inherent authority to discipline the troops for abuse. That doesn't mean Congress doesn't have the power to put down statutes about how you discipline the troops, and that those could override the president's contrary judgment. That's how you can have a torture act. That's why I think the conventional understanding would be that's constitutional. There are two aspects, I think, that make it a little bit tricky. One is, as Jamie rightly identifies, the emergency case. What if there's an imminent attack and you've got a statute that's in place that seems to cut off all possibilities, and yet you've got the fate of the nation at stake or some very, very serious attack about to occur? What's the president to do in that situation? But I think it's important to recognize that emergency claim has not been the claim of this administration. They have not been asserting a power of the president to act in exigent circumstances. They've been asking for a general power to act in the absence of legal controls over time, because they've now characterized the whole situation as an emergency. Right? From day one, 2001, until whenever it ends, we're in an emergency, so any action in that regard. Well, that's a plausible claim, I suppose, but it should be understood as a radically different kind of claim than the limited reference to emergency powers that Ford made at the very tail end of the Vietnam War, when he was confronted with statutes that gave him no power to act, or that Lincoln himself made at the very beginning of the Civil War, when Congress was out of session and there was an emergency facing the nation, and then he responded to it. And I think that's the troubling thing, is the massive extension of that claim. The other, I guess, point that I think is worth making about the hearings is just to say there has been a lot of criticism of the Senate in its conduct of confirmation hearings in recent years, particularly with respect to Supreme Court justices. The claim is they don't know how to ask a question, they haven't done any research, they're not asking the real things, and then they go to muck and personal invective because they've got nothing on substance to talk about. Whatever else you say about the Mukasey hearings as I read them, it was actually an instance where you could see why confirmation is a good idea and the framers were right to create it. The Senate asked real questions, and of course they asked them repeatedly. They're very serious questions. Should someone be subject to waterboarding? It's a totally legitimate question. It's not trying to trip someone up or catch them in a perjury trap. It's trying to figure out, what's your view on that question? He did not want to answer. That was revealing. Doesn't mean that he's a horrible person, but it was reflective of a sense that this was someone who is clearly conflicted or concerned about suggesting that waterboarding is torture and therefore is off the table. That gives you some insight as to how he might advise the president and other legal actors within the administration when he takes office. And I think that's a perfectly legitimate thing to make a vote on, given the seriousness of that issue. So I thought it was actually a good day for the Senate, the 2 days of hearings, and I thought they were quite respectful and quite serious hearings in which one could learn a great deal from. I think, as again, just to repeat, I think the worrisome thing, though, is that the answers that weren't given, I think weren't given for a reason, which is that I think the Attorney General is of a view that we're in an emergency situation post 9/11 that really alters the balance in his mind quite significantly from what otherwise would be the case vis-a-vis the president's compliance with law.
David, in your first few minutes, you said that you thought his views were profoundly wrong in very important areas. You've mentioned two just now, the emergency assertion and the waterboarding. Did you have some other major ones in mind?
Well, I just think this is reflective of this Commander-in-Chief override theory, and I guess I'd give you an example, again, from the Statement of Administration Policy. So what's this delta at the Category 3 lowest ebb circumstance? In the statute that was proposed, that the Statement of Administration Policy was issued in response to, the statute would have set a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq. One could say that's a bad idea. One could say it's the worst thing that you could do right now, given what's happened with the surge. But nonetheless, the response in the Statement of Administration Policy was not just that it's a bad policy decision. It says flatly that Congress has no constitutional power to impose a withdrawal date on the president because it would interfere with his powers as commander-in-chief. Now, that's a good deal broader even than an argument that a statute saying take this particular hill in battle is unconstitutional. This is a statute to terminate the war. And the position set forth there is Congress has no power to do that. Now, if you ask me, that's quite a broad view, and that's from Judge McCasey not objecting to it when it goes out as the administration policy 3 or 4 days after he finishes testifying about the authority of the commander-in-chief. To me, that shows that one would be right to be skeptical in listening to his answers about whether he's just being prudent or whether instead he's resisting taking quite a strong view of executive power that he knows will not go over well.
In defense of Attorney General Mukasey, and I must say, Charles, I have a strong objection dating back to my days in the Attorney General's office in the 60s. Anybody calling an Attorney General general, he's not a military officer, he has no rank. Attorney General modifies attorney, but Attorney General Mukasey was not Attorney General when that statement of administration policy was issued, as I understand it. You said his hearings were over.
I think he had taken office by that time. He was already in office. Yes, no, it would have gone through his office. Now, you could say, in fairness to him, that, you know, it's not a considered opinion of the Office of Legal Counsel. It's not his own statement. But I'm just saying that if one listened to the hearings and drew the conclusion that he was not answering certain questions, why was he not answering them?
Let me ask a question there? I don't know the answer to this. Much of the controversy surrounded his refusal to say whether or not he believed that waterboarding was torture. I think that was probably the flashpoint of the hearings. It has occurred to me that he might have been in a very difficult position coming in to be the Attorney General if there are ongoing matters involving individuals who took actions in reliance on authority that was purportedly conferred upon them by officials of the department and who might face civil or criminal liability. And with the Attorney General under oath and being in a somewhat juridical position, that he simply was under professional constraints, which he could not easily identify. I don't know that to be the case, but it struck me that that might well be that, and not simply equivocating on whether he as a person thought waterboarding was torture. So does anybody have any insight?
Well, he did say he thought it was repugnant, I believe. But was that not his? He did say it was repugnant.
He went on to give that as one of the reasons why he wasn't answering some of those questions. But as I recall it, he made it both retrospective and prospective that he didn't want anybody who's out there now doing these things to think that they were vulnerable because of something he said. So he seemed to be putting his imprimatur on it.
Why would there be any worry about this? I would think anyone who acted under former OLC advice would have a great good faith mistake of law defense. I can't imagine that a prosecution could ensue for someone who acted on the basis of a valid, duly executed Office of Legal Counsel opinion.
Of course you're right, Neil. But you could have an awful lot of courtroom and extra courtroom drama surrounding not only middle-level CIA officers, but people somewhat higher up the chain before you finally came to that conclusion. And I don't think the people who were pressing Mukasey were unaware of the possibility of being able to mount that kind of drama.
Can I just say one thing about this, which I think it's totally right that the Attorney General testifying is obviously worried about saying something about the illegal former conduct. In fact, when I worked for Walter at OLC, it was standard practice that we did not want to comment on prior actions already undertaken in their legality, that's not an attractive position to be in for a legal advisor, given the weight with which the words will be taken. At the same time, I do think there is a bit of an irony in defending the refusal to take a stand on this question. And it's the following. As Charles himself suggested, there were some terrible legal positions taken early on in the administration. Perhaps. And some quite terribly destructive things were done as a consequence of those legal positions. If one wants to repudiate them, at some point you're going to have to say the prior conduct was wrong. And so if we're into transparency and full disclosure, there's going to have to be a moment where somebody's willing to say, I recognize that it's not a useful thing generally for an attorney general or any legal advisor to comment on the legality of past actions already undertaken. But in order to clear the record and set us straight as to where we now stand, I want to let you know some of those things were unlawful and wrong. And I think that's why we praise Jack Goldsmith.
David, I don't understand why you're saying that. Why isn't it sufficient to say, as Mukasey did, such and such a practice is repugnant, and I, with a strong implication, that I will not authorize it? Why do you need to add to that a repudiation of past action?
Well, because I think in the absence of the repudiation, what one worries about is forthcoming statements by the administration suggesting that actually some of those past actions were vital to national security and therefore defensible, and we've seen that happen in the wake of his confirmation. That's why I think a cleaner repudiation would have been helpful.
Moreover,
I'd like to just
he
bring the one thought.
Let me just finish that one. He adopted as his own the footnote in the December 2004 he adopted as part of the footnote in the 2004 replacement of the Bybee memo signed by Assistant Attorney General Levin, which said that nothing in the replacement memo rendered any of the previously approved activities incorrect. And he stated that as though he was agreeing with it, so maybe there was a change and maybe there wasn't a change, and that's something that the committee certainly was entitled to know.
Several observations, and I'm glad I didn't have a chance to rebut because the conversation was actually quite illuminating. I think David is exactly right that Mike Mukasey is not Ed Levy. He's more like Griffin Bell. And I just happen to think that that is a more appropriate comparison, given the circumstances and the views. I think that the conversations we're having right now sort of kind of like puts me to mind that great question that John Hart Ely said, you know, what if Congress wanted to pass war powers resolution that actually works? You know, these kinds of spitting match between Congress and the executive happens all the time. It happens, obviously, in the context most aggressively with the declaration and cessation of war and the commitment and pull out of troops. And as you know, that every single president, Republican or Democrat, have resisted the requirements of the war powers resolution, even as they comply with it. And they said they do it as a matter of grace rather than as a matter of the statutory the command. The real question that I want to put on the table is that what does Congress do about it now? Right, there's a lot of conversation about they're violating our laws. The Delta is not as great as they really think it is. You know, I haven't seen a Bolin Amendment version for extra FISA surveillance. You know, withdraw all funding for these kind of activities. Even on the issue of waterboarding. Is there a congressional enactment that just simply says that waterboarding that answers the same question that was put to Judge Mukasey as a matter of legal interpretation? My understanding is there's not, and indeed there was a vote that was insufficient. Those are the kinds of concerns that I have. Is that great? Both sides have played their first round of the game. What is the second round, and why isn't Congress not facing up to that fight and using Judge Mukasey and other nominees as the tip of the spear?
Vieta, by previous agreement, we're going to stop for a minute and give the students at both ends of the line here a chance to answer some questions. Although if they don't have questions that they think are better than the panel's questions, we'll go back to the panel. We have one here.
Okay.
Speak loudly into the table.
Sorry. The debate is focused so far on the difference of on constitutionality viewed from the point of view of the president and that of Congress. I'm curious about the sort of implications of the Mukasey hearing had for his views on when there is some prior judicial precedent on the issue. For example, with the issue of waterboarding, the president asserts that it's part of the necessary powers to defend the country. Congress obviously, in large part, disagrees. But there has been some kind of judicial overview of that, in which prior courts have held that waterboarding does constitute torture and is therefore illegal. Though I don't know if it's ever made it to the Supreme Court in a final determination, but just kind of curious about that.
It's a very important point, and one which hardly ever has been made in this whole Congress president dispute and the whole beating of this president with sticks about his disregard for Congress. I don't believe there is a single instance where this president has defied a order of the Supreme Court. And he's had a few, which I'm sure he found very distasteful, but there's been none of that. So the role of the Supreme Court as the final arbiter of these very questions that Walter and Viet and David are raising has not been questioned, has not been challenged. And that's very interesting. That's a very interesting point, and one which has not been emphasized enough. So thank you for bringing that up. Now, whether some district court somewhere in the context of something or another has said something about something which looks like waterboarding, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about Rasool. I'm talking about Hamdan. And there, there has been not a breath of defiance.
Charles, I don't think that defiance is really the right bar to set here. First of all, most of these issues arise in the context of national security and opinions which, but for chance, would never see the light of day. And I think that is why the Department of Justice has a special obligation to try to make its legal analysis transparent, consistent with the needs of national security. So if you have to only make the opinions transparent to those who are cleared, so be it. But what you have here is an inability on the part of the coordinate branch of government to the legislative branch to determine whether the legal analysis used by the executive branch accords with the opinions of the judicial branch. And that, I think, has been an exacerbating fact. You know, I would more readily share a sense of depression about hearings and confirmation hearings, particularly since I've been through them twice and they're not always terribly much fun, if I weren't sympathetic to a very frustrated Senate, which is contemplating a series of decisions at the intersection of national security and civil liberties, perhaps the most sensitive decisions a government can make, with no real ability to understand how we got where we got to and whether the other views of the Constitution might be ones that should be considered. And there, I think, I come back to my first comment, because if you take Judge Mukasey at his word, that he's going to review the opinions to make sure he is comfortable with them, and B, that he will share opinions to the extent practicable. And I, you know, there's a truck you could drive through some of the caveats there. But if you take him at his word that is an intention, I think a good bit of this tension will go away. But until you can make those judgments and the basis, therefore, more apparent to other branches of government, you are not going to have buy-in. You are actually going to end up with less executive power in the end. And you will have the frustrations of the Senate visited on not just this nominee, but the however half a dozen that are to come, because there's no other venue for that discussion.
There's no doubt about that, Jamie. And I think my remarks have been by and large critical of the legislative branch, but I completely share Jack's criticism of the executive branch, that and I think several, whether it was Veit and Walter and others, have made this point that this president has completely unnecessarily turned everything into a constitutional level confrontation, with the result that the executive is weaker now than when any of us ever heard of David Addington. I mean, that is a remarkable accomplishment, and yet that is what's happened, and it is the result of a profound lack of political skill. And what my plea is for better politicians all around, more skillful politicians, and politicians with better internal compasses. Mukasey, I think, has that.
There's a very interesting debate. There's an interesting debate. You and Jamie are on one side, along with Jack Goldsmith, and on the other side is Charles Savage, who wrote the Boston Globe, who wrote that book, over whether what has been done in the sort of Cheney-Addington new era has strengthened or weakened the presidency. And Savage takes the view that it's going to be very hard to cut back on the aggressive assertions of presidential authority, and that this presidency on steroids is going to be largely permanent. And I thought about that debate, and I think that you're all right. That is to say, the Savage is right in a very narrow sense.
Speaking of politicians.
No, but I'll say precisely that. Savage is right in the narrow sense that where there is a particular ruling of OLC, it is very difficult for the subsequent head of OLC to tell the president that, and the attorney general, the law does not allow you. I know how much you want to do it. I cannot agree to it. The law does not allow it. Oh, and by the way, to get to that position, I'm overruling a former OLC opinion.
This is precisely why the commitments that were exacted from Mukasey are so important. When members of the Senate Judiciary Committee asked me, what should we be asking? I said, the one thing that this country needs from Judge Mukasey's tenure is an honest assessment of those opinions, mm-hmm. albeit by somebody who is quite conservative and very aggressive on executive power, consistent, as Charles said, with the stated views of his president, to make sure that there are no Augean stables to be cleaned out when his successor comes in the door. And I think that is critically important. Now, it may be that as administrations ebb and flow and different people come into the office of the Attorney General and the head of the Office of Legal Counsel, that the successors in the Office of Legal Counsel will find themselves with opinions with which they disagree. But I doubt you will find, I hope you will find that at the end of his tenure, the opinions are not of the sort that he characterized the Bybee opinion as being, which is both, I can't remember the phrase he used,
wrong and
a mistake.
Now, the reason I think Savage is wrong, there are two words for the reason he's wrong, Rasul Hamdan, and maybe the one that's coming, the case that's coming up. Those cases are now, it's not a question of what OLC says. Those cases mean it's a new ball game. And I think those cases were wrong. They were wrongly decided. Sorry, Neil. they were wrongly decided, but they are there now. And that means it doesn't matter what OLC says on that subject. There's another example. Which, from an entirely different context, which I'd like to raise. Last, was it last term or the term before, there was a decision in the Supreme Court, also wrong, on whether the EPA had the power and the obligation to make rules about greenhouse gases. The standing part of the Supreme Court's decision, I think, may have been right. The statutory interpretation was egregiously wrong and governed by political correctness of the worst sort. Okay, why did we get that? We got that because of an administration which in every area, whether it is the effect of abortion on women or FDA or global warming, has fussed with, has changed, has really distorted the opinions of neutral scientists, so that its views could no longer be trusted. And Justice Kennedy just obviously liked science, and he thought this administration can't be trusted, so let's slap them down. And we paid a terrible price in terms of a very wrong decision. That's the kind of price that we were paying for this administration. We paid that kind of price for Nixon. Wasn't worth it.
Charles, let me
follow up on that, Charles, for 1 second. I mean, you said before, well, that this administration hasn't defied the Supreme Court. And I understood Jamie as saying, that's really the wrong question. And I would say to you, the right question is, you know, how much law have they substantively gotten wrong in the face of this Supreme Court, which tends to be, after all, quite conservative? I mean, if you think back over American history, you have to, presidents do not lose cases in times of armed conflict. And, you know, here they've lost them in Rasul with detention. They lost them in Palmdi with detention of American citizens. They lost Geneva Conventions in Hamdan. They lost military tribunals in Hamdan. You really have to try if you're a president to do this and lose. I mean, it's kind of like failing a class at Harvard.
Well, we're agreeing. I agree with you. That's why Charles Savage is wrong.
Right, Charles. I think that you're absolutely right that there's agreement here. You can think, as Charles does, that the Supreme Court got it wrong, and also restate your question. It's not whether this administration's got it wrong and then the Supreme Court got it right. But from Charles' perspective, I happen to agree with it. Even if the Supreme Court got it wrong, it was predictably wrong. You could see this a mile away. That's exactly what Jack reveals in his book, saying, hey, Paul Clement has warned us about this for 3 years, so let's do something before the train wreck hits us.
But I'm lost, guys, because I really don't think that this is a good way to think about it. So if the Supreme Court invalidates unilateral presidential action, why does that show that we have a weakened president? Right. So what would he have done instead? He would have presumably gone to Congress and gotten authorization beforehand, and then it would have presumably been upheld. But of course, Rasul doesn't preclude that. And in the wake of Rasul, there was statutory intervention by the Congress, which was sympathetic to the president. Similarly, with respect to Hamdan, right? He lost unilaterally, and he goes back to the Congress, and then Congress then empowers him in various ways to the, you know, discouragement of many of the people who litigated that case. So if you look at it from the perspective of Addington, I think it's an odd conclusion to say that the president's legal strategy here has been ineffective from his point of view, because what he's done is push the envelope sufficiently far that what Congress is then forced to do is essentially comply. And the bet that they've made is a bet that in the current atmosphere post 9/11, it's very hard for the legislature to be on the side of curbing presidential aggressive action in times of terrorism, because you will be then accused of inhibiting the ability of the federal government to protect the nation. And if you look at what happened with respect to FISA, I think David Addington's got to be feeling that this was a very successful strategy. Imagine the alternative.
Successful, except it concedes that it needed Congress.
Exactly.
That's a concession he wouldn't have wanted to make.
Well, but he would also have lost entirely. There was a statute. I mean, there's a statute saying it's a felony, so he violates it in secret. Yeah. Then the consequence, why did they not go to Congress initially to get the approval for FISA? According to Attorney General Gonzalez, it was simple. They thought they would never get it. Why wouldn't they have gotten it? Because it's not so easy to walk into Congress and say, what we'd like to do is remove warrant protection for spying on Americans. That's how it would have been sold. They knew it would have been very hard to get through. It's much easier to get it through if you've been doing the practice for 6 months, 12 months, and there's no hint of abuse, and there's been no attack, and you then say, you really want to take this away from me? And I think that's the bet they've been making all along. And so far, I don't think they've been proved wrong about that. But that doesn't really indicate to me that the solution to this is to say, well, they've really weakened the president. A strong president would never act this way. I think this
That's really very clever, David.
You may well be right.
One at a time. Let's keep it to 1 minute at a time because we only have a few minutes left.
You have one minute. The policy. I agree with you, David, that if that's the analysis holds, you do win the policy the midterm policy win. But long term, Charles has got to be right that the presidency is hurt with decisions like Hamdan Rasool and soon would mean on the books.
Well, I guess take issue with that. I don't think the presidency was the hurt in the least by the Youngstown decision. Right?
Youngstown.
That was a case that curbed the power of the president. I don't think that hurt the president one bit. I don't say Truman weakened the presidency. Truman did something, and then it was limited. And that doesn't mean you have a weak presidency. That means you have a presidency who's acting under law now, and it's an accommodation that one can make. And so I guess I would say the right way to think about the question is not, has he weakened the presidency or strengthened the presidency? What do you want the presidency to be? What should the powers of the president be? And we should think about that as a nation and have presidents who try and reach some balance in much the way Jamie was describing as a sort of an accommodative process, which for a long time was the one that held sway.
David, I think it's weakened in one sense, though I totally take your point about Hamdan and Rasool, but it's weakened in the following sense. I think we have virtually an entire political party, as well as the American Bar Association, who believe that no president ever should have the authority to declare that he's not going to enforce a provision because it's unconstitutional. And I worry that that will be accepted as part of the legal culture when that party, to which I often adhere, comes into power again, and that it will be a result of someone having claimed that everything we don't like we call unconstitutional and disregarded, and they've come in such.
It's a little bit like the well-accepted view, accepted on newspaper editorial boards, that there's a First Amendment right of journalists to refuse to answer questions in grand juries.
Right.
Well, I mean, your analog there is perfect because it's well accepted by editorial boards about reporters, and here you have. We have a conflation of the battle between the executive and legislative branches and the battle over who decides what about the Constitution. And that's where the point that Walter's making comes in, because there are Democrats, myself among them, that believe in a very strong executive. Right. And so I don't agree with many of my friends on the Hill when they assert that some of the things that the Bush administration has done are obviously unconstitutional.
Jamie and Walter, how do you then parse what Mukasey said? I think, reflecting the administration point of view, the president must follow constitutional law. If the law falls outside the Constitution, the president must follow the Constitution. How do you work with that when the president also claims the right to determine what's constitutional and what's not constitutional?
But Jim, that is what we've been talking about for the last hour and a half. That delta there is precisely the ambiguity that was left in the hearing. That is there, what is that ebb? What's left? What does that mean? And for me, I believe that there is something left, but it is, you know, and the examples I can give, as David said, are all about, you know, imminent harm. They're in the national security area. They're temporary. I mean, this is what you heard from Walter, too.
That's not what Addington would say that sentence means. Addington would say the president can determine what his rights are.
Well, but who is, if not the president in that delta, who is to determine? Now, of course, The courts can. That's
if
right.
If they can get
but
the case.
Surely it begs the question to say, well, Congress can determine what's in that. That can't be right, Jim, because the point of the Delta is that it's the power, Congress, the president's power to ignore Congress.
Congress can make the Delta smaller and smaller.
But it can't squeeze it out altogether.
That's the question.
Well, here's what happened. I had this debate with Judge Mikva when he was White House counsel, and he had come from Congress. And he was very skeptical that the president could ever decline to enforce a law, a provision of a law that he had signed. And I insisted that every president had taken that position, and we would too. He said, well, then the president can simply, it gives the president the authority to decide whatever he wants to comply with or not. I said, no, it doesn't. He has to have a legitimate, solidly grounded legal opinion from the chief legal officers of the government that there's a good faith argument that it is indeed unconstitutional.
And he said that means the president can do whatever he wants, right?
But there are always the courts. There are always the courts which can adjudicate that dispute.
That leads, Waller, to your memo, which Attorney General Mukasey cited two or three times during the hearing, saying that in the specific context of an invocation of executive privilege to defend against a congressional subpoena, that the Justice Department can decide and the president can decide that that was a justified reliance on the president's position, and that ends it, and then it can never get to court.
That's
Did
correct.
Did you say that in your memo? And is
absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Jim, have you noticed it never has gotten to court? Ever? Have you noticed that?
Well, Jim, perjury has gotten to court, certainly. Perjury by federal officials before Congress. And if that's the only way you
contempt,
can go,
contempt.
You have that.
No, we're talking contempt.
But contempt is a different problem. Yeah. And we do have a statute there. The statute says the United States Attorney must refer it to a grand jury. What does that mean?
You remember the Burford incident in the 1980s, right? Because, you know, Ann Burford got a criminal contempt, and Stan Harris, the U.S. attorney, says prosecutorial discretion. I'm not going to send it to the grand jury. There was no noise about impeaching the U.S. attorneys and impeaching the attorney general. In the end, they accommodated, and the grand jury did not return an indictment. I wonder what the U.S. attorney's recommendation on that indictment was. And this is the same position that Wilma Lewis took in the Clinton administration as the U.S. attorney for D.C. It's a perfectly legitimate position.
Let me give you an example, a simple example. Congressman Barr, let's say, subpoenas all the records in the White House having to do with everyone who was considered for the position in which Ruth Ginsburg was nominated to the Supreme Court. This is like they want to see all the internal papers on the White House consideration of the nomination. The White House counsel, the president, acting on the advice of the attorney general, the president invokes executive privilege. The attorney general writes and signs an opinion that, in his or her opinion, that invocation is properly taken. And then Congress refers it to prosecution, refers to the statute that says a U.S. attorney shall refer it for prosecution, right? In that instance, you can't prosecute someone where you know they have a valid defense. It is an abuse of the process to bring a prosecution where the defense is well taken, which is, I acted on a legal determination of the Attorney General of the United States that this was a proper invocation of executive privilege, and therefore I cannot be prosecuted for contempt. It's just
Walter, bingo.
Right.
Well, we will find that out for at least on the Senate side, because Senator Leahy is clearly leading towards a position where he is going to rule, if they continue with the position, if the witnesses continue with their position, that he's going to say the invocation of executive privilege is overly broad and unjustified and does not outweigh Congress's need under U.S. v. Nixon to breach the qualified privilege. Somebody has to decide that. And is the president going to be the last word, or is a court going to be the last word?
Let me say, can I say for the record, I agree that the privilege is not well taken in the U.S. Attorney's scandal, that there that there is a sufficient evidence of wrongdoing that you must turn that over.
So what's the remedy?
Well, the remedy
politics.
It's an inter-branch spitting match.
And also, there are articles of impeachment. I'm quite serious. The constitutional framework was, if you have a bad faith invocation by the president, the answer is not that you substitute the judgment of an assistant U.S. attorney.
Well, we're back where we started, and it's 1:30. Charles said impeachment's a very blunt, sloppy instrument, and if that's the only place we can go between the president deciding and having a remedy, we've got a problem. Maybe there's a legislative solution, maybe not. To be continued, I'm sure, by all of us personally, and maybe we'll have to have another one of these quarterly to see how it's going. Thank you so much,
thank you,
everybody at both ends, and we'll look forward to doing this some more.
Thanks, Jim, for being together.
Yeah. Thank you, Jim.